wanted to do in this last session is sort of talk about where Pentecostal women ministers are today in their experience. We heard last night, those of us who were here, we heard stories of actually where people are ministering, and we've heard some other things today about that. But there are a lot, as is always the truth in case, there's always sort of these myths that are out there about what it's like and why it's this way and what's going on and those kind of things, what the barriers are or whatever. And then there are these realities. And so what I've tried to do in this section is look at some of the latest material that is available on Pentecostal women and where in the United States, though there are studies that have been done, especially of Scandinavian women Pentecostals and of women in French-speaking countries around the world. There's a massive volume only available in French. My French is really bad, so I had to rely on like book reviews of it and everything to kind of access what it was about. And I will say that research, though, there's a lot of different ways to do this kind of research. You can do surveys, you can do interviews, you can do, you know, ethnographic studies, you can do all these different things. But all of it kind of corroborates the other findings. And so what I'm going to present is a pretty representative, I think, of where women as Pentecostal ministers are. Now, this first piece comes from research that I helped with, along with one of my former deans, Dr. James Bowers. This was actually his sabbatical project, and I'll tell you a little bit about the background. In 2010, we had one of those horrible years of at the Church of God General Assembly when yet again women in leadership was pushed down. There were other strides forward that were made, like women being able to serve on certain boards and things like that, but the still women at leadership was pushed back. So a group of scholars got together at SPS again to say, so what are we going to do about this? This keeps happening. How can we as scholars try to make a difference? And there were actually about 50 of us who gathered there, most scholars, but also scholars who were pastors. And so one of the people there was Dr. Estrelda Alexander, whose work I was quoting this morning. She's a Church of God minister, an African-American woman. She's a theologian, PhD from Catholic University. She's, you know, like top of the line scholar. And she just said in her kind of, as only Estrelda can say, well, has anybody ever asked women what they want? You know, because it's usually like other people talking about women. What do women really want? And so they kept talking and they said, well, what we need is a survey of Church of God women to say, what is it you want? What's your experience? So this meeting was called by actually Estrelda and Dr. Dale Coulter, who teaches with me at Regent, and Dr. James Bowers, who was dean of the seminary in Cleveland, had done some work, some empirical work, research, where they had surveyed a lot of Church of God pastors back in 2006 or something like that. So they said, could you do something? So he said, well, I will if I can get some help. And so he asked Estrelda and I if we would help. But he did all the kind of constructing the technical parts of it because it was he was on sabbatical. And we kind of helped him think about the questions and then we analyzed it. So here's what this was in 2012. Now, granted, this is Church of God, but the stuff I've brought to you for this is the research that we found that actually does correlate with some of what you're dealing with in the PH Church, not all of the issues that just Church of God is facing. So here's how we did it. There are something over 3,000 credentialed women ministers in the Church of God in the United States. That's not the rest of the world. And so one of the limits of this study is it's just ministers in the United States. And the other one of the other limits is we only printed it in English. So Spanish-speaking women ministers, even in the United States, who couldn't speak English, didn't have access. But, you know, this was all like, it's basically out-of-pocket expense for James Bowers. And so, you know, you can only do what you can do. So we had email addresses for 2,379 of all of the women ministers. So that's 77% of all credentialed women ministers. So it's 3,088. We crafted this survey, sent it out to all 2,379, and we got a response rate of 30.5%, which, if anybody knows anything about statistics, that's a really good response rate. Normally it's less than 25%. And so that meant that 726 surveys were returned, which also means that was 23.5% of all the women credentialed ministers in the Church of God in the United States responded. So that's pretty good. We know we got a good sampling of what women believed. They were diverse in ethnicity and in age, and also compared pretty favorably with the whole U.S. population. And it was published in 2013 as this book, which is still available like this on Amazon. It's being reprinted by Wiffenstock, and so it won't be available in this format, but it's the same information. So basically, what did we find? Well, one of the big things that always gets said for those people who are, against women in ministry is this is just some liberal feminist agenda being pushed, right? This is liberalism. This is, some encroachment. But what we found, based on the questions we asked, is that it's not being driven by that kind of agenda, because these women self-identify as both politically and theologically conservative. These are not flaming liberals, okay? And if you ask them what their view of family is, they hold a very conservative view of family. Okay, so that was the first major finding. We also found that women ministers overwhelmingly believed that Scripture permits them to lead at all levels of ministry. Now, I'm not giving you all the statistics here, but you can find those in the book. Women, when asked, what does Scripture say, cite narratives. They cite things like Deborah or Priscilla, right? They, like you've done with Deborah's daughters. Whereas we also sent out the same survey that had been crafted so that, you know, just to change the language for men and their opinions about women in ministry, we sent it out to like 1,000 randomly selected male ministers in the Church of God. And these were all at the highest level of ordination, ordained bishops. And they all cite Pauline text. So women read the Bible differently than men read the Bible. I mean, it was just glaring. Now, let me say that the random sampling, we didn't have as high a return rate on that. And when you're doing that kind of a random sample like that, let me say this first. And I'm not a statistician, so I've just had to lean on a couple of people who work with me who are really good at this kind of thing to help me understand what's going on. But the people who answer surveys like that often are people who feel like really strongly about things, you know? So, you know, but we also could compare it to this survey that had been done in 2006 of pastors, which didn't deal with issues of women, but it did look at other things like demographics and all of that. So we know that those that did return it were pretty much, it was a good sample of men compared to this larger survey that had been done earlier, if that makes any sense. So this was a major finding, that women are reading the text a little bit, well, quite a bit differently. They go to narratives and rather than the Pauline text first. We asked, okay, so if Scripture is not... maybe it's time to lock that door. We asked, okay, so if Scripture doesn't prohibit women from this, what does prohibit women? Why aren't more women leading and pastoring and all of that? The number one reason cited by women, 58% of them said, it's the trouble men have with women in leadership that's the problem. The second highest, and we gave them a list of various things. So these numbers don't add up to 100% because they could choose, you know, out of this whole random list of things. The next highest percentage was 46% said that women can't lead because they're not getting support from denominational leadership to lead. And then third was lack of support in congregations for women. Men, however, cited very different things for the other barriers. 60% of them said it violates the God-ordained order of the home. 51% says it violates the God-ordained order for society. 33% said it's the problem that some men have with women, though those two other higher statistics might say it's a higher percentage about, you know, that particular issue. And then the fourth one, also at 33%, was, sadly, that women are less emotionally well-suited to be pastors or leaders. And let me just give a little commentary on that particular opinion. I've been to a lot of conferences and General Assembly of the Church of God where this was discussed. I have heard some men get like incredibly emotional about this issue. I mean, like weeping, crying, carrying on, all but calling names. So the argument that women are less emotionally well-suited, that women are going to get emotional about things, just really doesn't fly with me, because I'm watching these men discuss this issue and getting really, really emotional about it, you know. So, but it's really interesting that a third of them, now again, that was a random selection, and the statistics may not be quite that much if you had a larger sample. This was a major finding. Only 14% of these male ministers and less than 10% of the female ministers said that the biggest problem is increased risk of sexual misconduct if men and women are working together. Now that's important, because that is almost a number one argument that gets listed in these emotional exchanges. Well, we can't have women on ministers' retreats because, you know, or, you know, women, men, we like to go away on these, you know, the deacons, we like to go on retreats and we can't have a woman along. And I'm thinking, why do y'all sleep together? I mean, what is the problem? We have youth camp with men and with boys and girls, so there, it's possible, you know. And I always think when I hear that I think that is more your problem, right? So it gets touted a lot as a big issue. But when it came down to it, it was very low. So that was a myth. That everybody thinks this is a real problem. Actually, they don't think it's a real problem. Are women affirmed? Now, these people are not Church of God, but they're Pentecostal. I just wanted to lift this picture up because I just saw it like a week ago. This young woman, Lisa Olson, works at Regent. I say young, she's probably in her 50s. She was born with no arms or legs. Her mother had taken thalidomide when she was pregnant, which for like morning sickness, and they found out later that it caused severe birth defects. And she works at Regent, and she has obviously a wheelchair, but literally she has no limbs. She was just ordained to ministry last week by Ann Jimenez at the Rock Church International. The week before her ordination, she had been in Phoenix at a major conference speaking. This past year, she spoke before a huge crowd in Bogota, Colombia. So I put that picture up there just for all of you women out there, all of us, everybody doing anything in life. If Lisa Olson can do all of this, I think we got like no issues that should keep us back, right? So, but she was affirmed. This is Ann Jimenez at Rock Church, who's the bishop, Rock Church International, and her son-in-law, John Blanchard. So another issue that we wanted to know is, and this is gets into this whole thing of experience, is are women really being affirmed in their ministry if they're called? And this is important because what is ordination, right? It's affirmation of your call. That's what it's all about. It's the church recognizing and affirming what God is doing in your life. So 76% of the women said that their call had been recognized before their local congregation. But you're kind of wondering, well, what about that other 25, 24%? If you've been credentialed, how have you not been recognized? Because that is what it, that's the first step, right, in to be recognized. Then we ask, are you being given opportunities to preach, even though you're credentialed? And all these are credentialed, by the way. Remember that. So only 74% said they were given opportunity to preach. 51% said that the entire credentialing process was even explained to them by the gatekeepers. They had to find that out themselves. 32% said the educational process, because like your school of ministry here, there's one in the Church of God, and you can actually get college credit for the work you do through Lee and everything. 49% said that their pastor even did any prayer for discernment with them. These statistics just broke my heart. Only 41% said their pastor had introduced them to denominational leadership. Now, one of the things that we know from studies in the corporate world and in everything is that the only way women can break these glass ceilings in anything is if they have not just mentors, but sponsors. You got to have somebody at the top who brokers things for you and introduces you to people. And that is, you know, I'm not going to say anything about your denomination, but I can just tell you in the Church of God, it's all about that. It's who you know, who they introduce you to, who gives you the opportunities, and all that. And I imagine it's similar. But only 41% of them had ever had their pastor introduce them to denominational leaders. And only 44% had their pastor sponsor them in the training programs of the denomination, which is their job as pastor to do that, right? Okay, other findings. And this will take a little bit of explanation to try to help you get these figures, but in the Church of God, there is a scale that is a suggested pay scale for pastors, and it's based on church membership. And we ask women, what is your ministerial income? Not your income, but your ministerial compensation. 65.1% of them are making less $5,000 or less in ministry compensation. 80% make $20,000 or less, and only 4% make $50,000 in ministry compensation. And remember, this could have included, we don't know who answered the survey necessarily, but there were some educators involved in this. And so this is ministry compensation. On the other hand, male ministers, only 11.5% of them made $5,000 or less in ministry compensation. And only, and less than 20% had ministry compensation of $20,000 or less. Now, this is important because we were asking women who are, you know, they're at the level that they can reach in credentialing, as are men. But because men in the Church of God can be at a higher level of credentialing, their earning potential is more. And this is demonstrated by this, okay? So more than 80% of women earn less than $20,000 in ministry compensation, while 80% of men surveyed earned more than $20,000. So one of the things that I wanted to say is, you know, that, you know, they have that day, I think it hits at about April, where in this country, where women have had to work this long to make as much as men did at the, by the end in December, you know, because the earning is like, what, 77%? Women make 77% of what men do. The Church of God that day would be like pushed up to like November or December, you know, it, or maybe into the next year even. So, and also, that means that 58% of these women are working in compensated employment outside of ministry, where only 31.5% of the men surveyed were. 62% reported they're not compensated for ministry, for their ministry at all. They're just doing this because they love the Lord and feel they're called. And only 15% of men reported that. 71.5% of those who are compensated outside of ministry, like they've got a job in an office or in the schools or whatever, receive no income from ministry, whereas only 30.8% of men surveyed do. We also asked about, but I didn't include these statistics, but we asked about housing allowances, and most of these women were not getting a housing allowance. The vast majority were not in a part of the retirement program for the Church of God. So basically what we're talking about is, you know, an impoverished workforce, though many of them are working outside. 74% report working part-time in ministry, but only 40% of these men. 83.7 do not receive, here it is, a housing allowance, while 40.5 surveyed of men don't. Another important thing we ask, have you ever been promoted to a larger, more or more viable congregation, which would be by the bishop of the region that you're in? Only 5.5% of those who pastored had ever been promoted to a larger congregation. So who are these women in the these typical women in the Church of God? Well, they are evangelists or church planters in small towns, and most of them have been there, if they're church planters, for over 10 years. So that's a pretty long-term pastor right there in a denomination where, you know, people move a lot. Most of them are bivocational, working 20 to 50 hours per week outside of ministry and up to 20 hours per week in ministry. Most of them make less than $5,000 a year in ministry compensation, and most have no housing allowance or retirement in the Church of God. They may have other retirement. Now, recently, and I'm just going to summarize these next slides, but recently the Assemblies of God pastor up in Yorktown, Virginia, wrote this blog piece that got picked up in a lot of places. And he's doing a PhD in some sort of economics theory stuff that I don't understand. But he wrote this blog about the economics of being a woman minister, which he called Women Need Not Apply. And he basically talked about the economics dilemma that women are faced with. So he paints this picture. So there's this woman, 22 years old, she's called and she's educated. She has a BA in ministry, then she can't find a job, a placement at church. Not that she's not qualified. She's just as qualified for an entry-level ministry position as a male counterpart with a BA. But he says it's because a 40-something-year-old male lead pastor believes it's not appropriate to mentor a 20-something female pastor. So she's without a job. 6 years later, she's not been mentored in ministry. Because she can't find a paid position, she goes to seminary, earns an MDiv, yet she still can't find a job because she's educated, but has no real paid ministry experience. Many male lead pastors will say they don't feel comfortable hiring a 28-year-old female with an MDiv, but when a male pastor cites uncomfortableness, he says, as the reason he won't hire a female, what often really is at play is his own insecurity at the idea of mentoring a woman who is younger and more educated than he is. Fast forward 33, she's called, educated, not mentored, and unemployed. She can't find a job in ministry, so she goes and gets a DMin, thinking, who wouldn't hire Dr. Me? Now, she's 33, possibly married with preschoolers, holds an MDiv and a DMin, and has volunteer but no paid ministry experience. So then a 60-something-year-old lead pastor says, well, she's educated, but she's young in the ministry with no paid experience. So she's now overqualified and too old for an associate pastor's role. So Jamie concludes, she becomes a consultant or a speaker. She never really fulfills the pastoral calling God has put in her heart, but she has a great blog. And that's about the only way she really gets to fulfill her call. So what do women need, based on the survey that our findings, what we concluded is that women, first of all, need to be heard. And importantly, they need to be included in the conversations about gender in ministry. It doesn't need to just be at the level where it's just men talking about whether or not they should. They need to be heard. Second, there's a need for recognition that their pursuit of full empowerment is not motivated by some desire to undermine traditional family values or not something necessarily associated with any liberal political leanings. And I know I keep driving that point home, but I can't tell you how many times I've heard that rhetoric. And it's not just in the Church of God. I teach at Regent, you know, and we have people from all kinds of traditions there. Third, there must be affirmation of her emotional confidence, her educational preparedness, her ministerial experience that's necessary for opportunities for service at all levels of leadership. She needs, there's a real need for conversation about how she reads Scripture differently on the question of gender and ministry than her male counterpart does. What's going on there, and why is that the case? Fifth, Pentecostal female minister needs a support system. If they're not being really mentored, if they're not being sponsored, and unlike most places, they don't have Deborah's Daughters in most areas of the denomination. They don't have a support system of other women ministers and older ministers who are older than them in the Lord. So they really need that, or they're not going to flourish not just as ministers, but as humans, because they feel denigrated. And they need to be recognized as strategic missional partners for the 21st century. Now, let me just, I don't know how it is in the PH. I've looked at some of your programs from time to time. But most of the time, you know, we have big pushes in Pentecostal churches about church planting. To date, I have never seen one of those programs that has women as the speaker telling you how to plant a church. But if women are planting all the churches, it seems like you ought to get women in there to tell you how to get it done, right? And I don't know how it is in the PH. I can speak for the Church of God. I can speak for other groups that I've looked at, Assemblies of God. They'll have like a whole church planting office, and it's just like some young, hip-looking guy in there. He may not have ever even really had success planting a church, but he's read a lot about it, you know, and he's got a lot of good ideas. I'm not saying he can't contribute, but if you've got these women who've planted churches and they're still going after 10 years, it seems to me that they would be strategic ministry partners if you're wanting to plant churches, because they've been doing it. I've yet to see that. I've yet to see a woman church planter on any of those lists. Now, let's talk about y'all a little bit and others like you. You fully ordain women, but there is still this kind of stained glass ceiling that, as we've talked about. Last week or week before, Pentecostal Assemblies of Canada, sister denomination to the Assemblies of God in Canada, released a statement. They too fully endorse and fully ordain women. But in the statement they said, "We recognize that although our accepted official position is one of equality between men and women, that position has not translated to reality. Women continue to be vastly underrepresented, both as vocational pastors and in governing roles at district and national levels. Despite female students consistently attending our Bible colleges in significant numbers, there is a gap between our official position and our lived reality." And a blogger from the Pentecostal Assemblies of Newfoundland, a sister denomination, said of this, "We aren't practicing what we believe." So the reality is that even in most groups that have full ordination, full participation on the record books, it's not translating into lots of women pastors and women at leadership positions. So it's not, something's going on. It's not enough to say we do it. There's some reason that's not happening. And here's your statistics for the North Carolina Conference. Karen got these for me. You may want to, Karen, do you want to talk? You got these from the...
Well, we just used our database to go through and get this information.
Okay.
And then I actually just sent you an email, but we were able to gather from three other conferences as well.
So okay. Yeah, we'll compare that. So out of 626 total ministers, 145 of those are women and 481 are men in your conference. But only 9 of those 145 women are pastors, while 195 of those men are pastors. Okay? And that translates to, according to Karen, and this is her rough math, but roughly this, and she said that in the email, that's the reason I'm saying that. Math's not my strength, but anyway. Approximately 50% of licensed or ordained men in the North Carolina Conference are pastoring, compared to about 10% of licensed or ordained women serving as senior pastors. I'll just let that sit there for a little bit. So women are ordained, 145 45 or credentialed, 48 are ordained, but only 9 are pastors, while for men, 195 are pastors. So, why? Why are there only 10% of women who are ordained, who are actually pastoring churches in this conference? So what are your ideas on that? And your bishop's in the room, so I know it's going to make it a little bit difficult for you to say. But he's a good guy. He's open to hear this, you know. So what do you think?
Well, I think that not everyone's called, as far as everyone's not called to, like, pastor a church. Like, I know that I'm called to children's ministry. I know I'm called to outreach ministry.
Okay.
But I'm not called to pastor a church. But I still, as a woman fixing to be ordained next year, I feel like that their credentials and the fact of ordination, I need that for my children.
Right.
I need that for my outreach.
Absolutely, yeah. You need, yeah. So do you think it is that God is not calling but 10% of the women to be pastors? I mean, that's a legitimate question. Is it that, you know, 50% of the ordained men feel called to pastor but only 10% of women? Is everyone who feels called to pastor, if the church is available, getting to pastor? Janice, you're shaking your head.
No, but I'm like Paula. I don't feel led to be a pastor. A lot of people say, are you want to be a pastor? And I just say, no, people are too mean. But that's not my deal, but I don't feel that the Lord has called me to be a pastor. He didn't call me to be a mother because I forget where I put the baby. So, but I still believe that the bishop touched on something last night that has really stayed with me since what he said. We do have good support from and we did our prior and the one before that. As a matter of fact, the three missions back was actually when Kevin Close got started in 2002. But I'm really seeing a whole strong thing about that. It's really the lay people in the church. You're dealing with the boards, and I have a whole fresh concept of that since I was here.
So you think a lot of the problem is on the part of congregations not accepting women?
I'm feeling that. Am I right, Bishop? That's really the case. I mean, that he knows what he does, and we wonder, did he ever ask that, can we be the pastor? But obviously he does, but if it doesn't get past that, I mean, you've got to get past the board.
Okay, I think that's huge. I think that's a big problem. The hearsay that I have from, even, as I mentioned this last night, even churches like the UMC or Presbyterian bodies that ordain women or whatever, is they may make the appointment and they may go there, but it's the same thing. You get a lot of resistance to women. I want to ask this, and this is kind of rhetorical, but I want you to think about this. Is it possible that women are not, you know, testifying of a call to pastor because there's other stuff kind of at work that's conditioning them to think, well, it's not going to work out for me to do that. I must not be called. I'm not willing to fight that battle, you know, whatever. So is it possible? And I ask that because out of 20 years of teaching in seminaries, I've seen women who come into seminary, both at Regent and at PTS. And let me, you know, go back and say, the Church of God has always actually allowed women to pastor. So, and I would say that if we compared in all the different denominations that do allow women to pastor, Pentecostal denominations, the percentages are probably about the same, whether there's like full participation on the books or not. Because the statistics are about 10% in the Church of God regions that I know of. I mean, that's pretty common, I'd say. But I saw women coming in with a strong call to pastor. And before seminary was over, they were going in to be counselors or chaplains. They're going into the military. Why? Because it's a safer zone. Now, it's a sad day when the military is a safer zone for women ministers than the church is, but it's the truth. And so they end up going into other forms of ministry because it's a more open market for them. They can just make that step easier. We saw a lot of women going into counseling, and that's great, but they were being something, and it wasn't what they were getting necessarily from faculty, because faculty were very much advocates for it. But I would have women come to my office and say things like, you know, I don't think my husband, I mean, I don't think my church pastor would be a good person for me to go to and talk to about going into the ministry and getting my credentials, because he's not very supportive. And so they try to, like some of these women apparently did, try to find ways to kind of get around that. Of course, I would always say to him, no, you need to go to him. It's their job, you know, and women have to push in, you know, you're going to have to do that. And some did, others would find other ways. But something is happening. What do you think? What are the other, what's going on? Are there not women feeling called?
I think.
Okay, go ahead. Okay.
Women have the most unique role of God's creation. We bear the children, we're mm-hmm. supposed to train them, and yet we're also empowered to be His ministers mm-hmm. in whatever field He's called us to be. And things are changing, yes, but a woman going into the North Carolina Conference now feels much more comfortable
yeah.
in approaching the leadership, which is predominantly male,
mm-hmm.
and has that more comfort level. Yet at the same time, she must have the ability to still recognize hidden prejudices
mm-hmm.
that can be displayed in writing and also displayed in body language. And that language doesn't always match, the tone doesn't always match what is said.
Mm-hmm.
So then she has to say, am I going to fight to that, even though I feel the call?
Right.
She has to decide then, am I going to accept a congregation that hasn't grown to the level yet to really accept a woman? Am I really willing
yeah.
to fight that battle?
Right.
Is my husband ready to take a second
yeah.
mm-hmm. position
yeah.
and go with me? Are my children, do I want to bear children? Because that's a tremendous responsibility in trying to care for our congregation
mm-hmm.
of people. So oftentimes you've gotten, the women weigh those things. And you begin, she may begin to say, okay, I don't feel like I can fight this right now.
Right.
At my stage of life.
Yeah. And so women, yeah, they get a later start a lot of times.
A later start in doing it, because by that time, maybe my husband can say, okay, I'll go with you, I'll follow you, or whatever. Your children are out and gone. And so you, she has the less pressure.
Right.
And then the woman has got to prove that she's better than the man preacher.
Right. Yeah.
She has to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
Not only to the conference, but she's got to prove it on that local level. I'm a good visitor to the hospital. I'm a good teacher to the teenagers. I am a good listener to the woman who's lost her husband or the man who's lost his wife.
Right.
And she just has to be 500% instead
yeah.
of 100%.
Right. Yeah. I think that's exactly the right picture of it. And then when they start and that kind of second stage, then as in Jamie Bold's case study, they may not get recognized because, well, they haven't really got any ministry experience yet, have they? And they're, you know, so it's, I mean, we see these studies about women in the corporate world as well. And I always, when I read those, I want to say, y'all ought to see what it's like in the church, because it's what happens there is even more magnified in the church. Karen, what were you going to say?
I just was going to circle back around what you were saying in the first session about you know, Baptist influence on lay people.
Yeah.
And I think that that's especially very much pronounced in the way that we perceive family systems and complementarianism.
Right. Yeah.
Versus egalitarianism.
Yeah. Yes.
It's hard to take a complementarianism view in the home and then go into the church and be egalitarian.
Right.
I think also the dynamics between particularly married ministers, the dynamics between the husband and wife has a lot to do with that too. A woman's willingness to fight
right.
the battle because.
Yeah.
So traditionally, the husband has been perceived as the main breadwinner, mm-hmm. and for him to be willing to be that position,
mm-hmm.
kind of.
Well, you know,
Blanche still here?
She had leave.
She used to refer to John as. She had some name for him, her husband. Who,
yeah.
She was a pastor, and he, I don't remember, but you know.
Right. Well, actually, one of the things, surprisingly, that this survey of Church of God women showed was that they had a lot of support from their family and even their husbands, which was I was thrilled with, because they need that immediate support system. But it also was pretty clear that most of their support system was coming from their family and sometimes people outside the denomination. They just weren't getting much inside. And, you know, and the stories that, you know, you were talking about, the language that's used. There's one woman who's a pastor of a congregation down in outside of Fort Lauderdale, Dr. Diane Mann. And she is a single mom. I think she had maybe adopted her daughter. She was raised on the mission field. Her parents were missionaries to Haiti. And anyway, but she was a state evangelist in Florida for the Church of God for a lot of years. And she said that, you know, it came time to camp meeting, all the state evangelists had these green blazers that they wore on evangelism day or whatever, you know. And so there she was in the choir with the other guys, and she's in her green blazer. And whoever it was up there, I don't know if it was the evangelism director or the overseer, whoever stands up and says, you know, can we give our brethren back here a hand? And she's sitting there, and she said she got a letter one time from the state office to Reverend or Pastor Mann and wife. And she called the state office and said, I've never had a wife. I don't have a wife now, and if I did, you'd have a bigger problem than this. You know, so, you know, these kind of automatic form letters, the form language, I mean, this is what she said she pushed, you know, the language here always says he, you know. And that may seem like women are pushing back at just semantics, or they need to get over that. But I have had very strong women ministers, pastors, contact me and say, you're not going to believe what they said in camp meeting and how it made me feel. You know, and jokes about women that a pastor tells to be funny and to get the crowd going, and it belittles women in some way. You know, or even getting up and saying, I'm not sure yet, you know, the Lord hasn't really given me anything yet on the whole women's issue, and there's women pastors sitting there, you know, and here's the speaker, you're supposed to receive from the Lord from this person who doesn't know if you're legitimate and what you're doing. I mean, I think the idea of that I'm thought of as illegitimate in some way is really damaging to the way women see themselves. Yeah.
I started school ministry in August, and there was something said at the first, I think it was the first class, that I really appreciated about this denomination. They were talking about trying to get like an internship program up and running. So it would be organized. So you wouldn't be on there as necessarily paid, but you'd be an intern, and you'd be trained under somebody for a certain amount of time. So, I mean, I thought that that definitely, like, pushed past some barriers.
Yes. The Church of God has an internship program like that for your first year of credentialing. You have to go through that. And so, you know, I think that's a really, it kind of pushes that situation, right, of even a male minister having to oversee, supervise a woman, you know, in ministry and give them. And part of the requirements in the Church of God is they, during that internship, they have to preach a certain number of times. They have to help at a funeral. They have to, there's a checklist, you know, of just ministerial function. And so it kind of puts it on the, okay, the, if this pastor is going to supervise, they got to make this happen, you know, and it forces them into that situation, even, you know, I mean, you don't want to put, here's the other thing too, as a bishop, you know, or over an internship program or whatever, you don't want to put a woman or even a young male minister in a situation that's just going to be this uphill battle and fight for them. But let me say this, and I am not in any way, I don't want y'all to hear this as me saying anything negative about your bishop, okay? Because he's in the room here, and I don't even really know him. And he's very supportive, and y'all are really, really, really blessed. But women in ministry really need for bishops to be bishops. And bishops need to support their ministers, you know? And that's what you really need. So if a woman pastor is in one of those congregations where there's men fighting back and, you know, obstructing and whatever they're doing, you know, bishops need to go in and straighten those things out. That, they straighten out a lot of other things in churches, you know, and so that's one of the things. And they can do that in a, and they should do it in a pastoral way. I'm not talking about whip, you know, cracking the whip. But I don't know what it's like in the PH Church anymore, but the Church of God, we have, we don't have, the day of the strong bishop who just kind of goes in there and tells the church, look, you're mistreating the past, that's pretty much over. They're more about conciliatory kinds of things, and in some cases that's really good. But when they're doing things that are obstructive to ministry, people, there's some people in congregations that just need to be corrected. You know, they're being rude. They're being wicked. They're being, you know, and I'm not just talking about the issues of women. There's, all y'all know all the stories, you know. But that's the reason a system like you have in your government is really helpful. Because if it's a congregational form of government, then you got no backup if you're in there. And so so you do have a covering of a bishop who can help in those situations. And sometimes it's just going to take, you know, well, we're going to have to appoint some women. So this is, you know, going to have to be done. Yeah.
I was just sitting there listening. I thought, you know, we say that but sometimes it's something even as the women, that we've been taught that women are not to be preachers.
Right.
But we're going after our license.
Uh-huh.
But inside of us,
you have self-doubt.
We still are not going to be a pastor. And even, I'm telling you something, and it's been a good journey, but it's been, I'm sitting there thinking, I thought you made me cry, I think because I thought back, it worked. I've sat in the church before, I went to a revival one night, and they asked all the preachers to stand up. And it wasn't a big church, we're talking a small church, maybe this many. And they recognized everybody in there. Here I am standing up. They passed me right by. I mean, they knew me. And it made
it won't
me. It weren't. But just tell you what, let me tell you, this is the Lord had. He said, go back the next night and stand back up.
Good for you.
I went back and I stood up and they did the same thing. Well, I went back the third night. I want you to tell you the third night they recognized me.
Good. Nevertheless, she persisted, like Margaret Gaines.
I never said a word to nobody. They never seen me cry, even though when I got home, I did. I held it, and I went back the next night, and I like everything was fine. But there has been a lot of hurt.
Yeah.
And it's but not just from the congregation. We're talking from other pastors.
Yes. Yeah.
That people don't realize when you get around a group of men and you say prayer, but guess who gets left out? I'm telling you, guess who gets left out? The lady. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to come to pray with the lady.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And
that's even the hype. Nobody wants to.
Well, it takes a kind of soft form of affirmative action. And what I mean by that is you have to, when you're planning a program, you've got to make sure you've got women represented, not just to sing, right? I mean, I've been singing in church all my life. I feel anointed to sing in church, but I don't want to just be the singer because, you know, and so you need to have, you know, you need to be very intentional about that and letting women do the things that people normally think of as like priestly function, like reading the Word of God and leading in prayer and then offering the sacraments and preaching and those kinds of things. There's a story I'd heard just recently, a young woman I just met. She's from Detroit area, Assemblies of God. You remember she's the woman who has a law degree who stood up and talked to Shannon is her name. The night before she came to SPS, she had been ordained in the Assemblies of God now. And she has a DMIN and a JD law degree. She's an African-American woman married to a white man. And so she's at this conference and they're Assemblies of God ordaining her. So they're all standing across the front. And they would come and give a Bible to the person being ordained. And they had read her name. And, of course, it's Shannon.
And
so,
a prayer shawl.
And a prayer shawl and put it around their neck. And, of course, Shannon could be a man's name. So her husband, being discerning, got down like he was tying his shoe. So clearly, surely they will get it that she's the one, if that superintendent didn't stand there and wait for him to get up from tying his shoe and try to hand it to him. And this was just March.
So, yeah,
in March.
He handed it to her.
And he handed it over
so
to his wife. Right. Right. Okay.
Like she said, everybody had a call, and then everybody had a call, and then different part of the Lord's kingdom. So my experience is kind of different. But it is really important that you had support from your husband. It is really important that the most important really is you had support from your husband. At the same time, you really focus on the Lord like that. Focus on the Lord and don't let anything hindrance you.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know that you had a call from the Lord, you had to fulfill that call like that.
Yeah.
As long as you had support from your husband, and then after when you go to the mission field, because I do go to the mission field, and then the Lord will send people in my way to help me there, like that, and my family in the Philippines would help me to do those work. Like that. So I guess the biggest thing is do not let anything hindrance you.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you know that you had a call from the Lord. Like that. As a woman, you're going to face a lot of hurts. Okay, I'm from the Philippines, and I had faced so much hurts. But that thing did not stop me.
That's right.
Because I know that I had a call from the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
I know that if I go to the mission field, my husband is not with me, but we are in unity.
Yeah.
We are in unity. So when I go to mission, I would stay 2 months or 6 months, whatever it is. My husband and I, we would communicate. He would pray on the phone, and we would talk to each other. I know that, and my husband know that it's time for him to call me like that. So the church in the Philippines is planted like that. My husband wasn't with me when it was planted. Right now it's a house church like that. But my heart, I love my family, but I love the Lord too.
Yeah.
As long as you had support from your husband, do not let anything stop you.
Yes, amen. Yeah.
As long as you focus on the Lord and you hear exactly what the Lord said, don't be afraid. Go for it. Go for it. This is it. Go for it. Don't be afraid with any man. Do not be afraid with any man. The most important, be afraid with the Lord.
Mm.
That's it.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Dr.
Alexander, yes.
I'm listening.
And I'm walking around because it's a little noisier in here this evening and afternoon.
Thinking about what Cindy has gone through and what many women in here and what Carmelita have gone through.
Yes.
But do you think that, I've wanted to say this all along, but I hope I don't lose the support of you women. But do you think as women, that we have to focus more, and I'm just going to use the word, on the confidence that we have in the Lord and be cautious about letting the dogma come out. I was thinking about what Margaret Gaines said. She said, you know, I might not have your approval, but I have the approval of the Trinity. But how you would say that and how you would go about expressing yourself like that would mean a whole lot to people that you're actually dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm confident and that I was called. Doesn't matter if I'm a woman, rather than having a dogmatic attitude of that I earned this because I was called from the Lord. And before we know it, we have pushed people back away from us.
Well, I think
caution that we need.
Yes,
to take.
But I have preached that before and said when a woman is confident and bold, they say she has a Jezebel spirit. But when a man is confident and bold, he's a strong leader and anointed.
That's right.
But the sad reality is that women have to do, almost nobody, a few of us would, but almost nobody ever judges a man preacher based on, you know, the outfit he's wearing, right? But a woman, you got to make sure there's all this stuff. Okay, is it, you know, if it's too plain, well, she's just trying to look like a man. If it's too fluffy and feminine, they're not taken seriously enough. You got to work on hemlines. You got to work on, you know, what's my hair? All of these different things. So, you know, getting back to this whole thing of women having this 500% better thing, there's so much because there are these standards that people have. And if I'm too forthright, then, you know, there's a word for that. And Jezebel is the kinder version of that. And so it becomes really difficult. So one of the things I've tried to do is I try to speak up for other people's rights and not my own. It's just kind of my own. I'm not advocating that you do that, but it's kind of like my own spiritual discipline is, okay, I'm going to stand up for you. To do this, I'm gonna, you know, rather than this being about me, and that helps me keep in check that I'm not getting a bad attitude about it. But yeah, I do think we have to be careful. I think we have to be, all ministers are supposed to be living and walking a blameless life, right? But you know, we have to be very careful about that and the way we speak, allowing love to temper how we judge. And it's helped me to think a lot about when I get pushback and harshness from men and women, it's helped me to stop and think and you know, Phil will know it's not my disposition to normally stop and think. We Newtons are not known for that. especially the women in the family. And but to stop and think, okay, his attitude toward me says more about him than it does about me. This is coming from somewhere here in him or her. They've got an issue. I'm probably not going to be able to correct that issue with my comeback. I'm just going to smile, say, you know, I've learned there's some phrases. People tell me, you need to do this, you ought to be, whatever. I'll pray about that. That's a really helpful little phrase. And I mean it, you know, but I don't, to try to, you know, well, thank you for sharing that with me, and then just walk away, you know. So I do think we have to be very careful. I think we have to be exemplary. I think we, unfortunately, we work ourselves to death because we take every opportunity offered because we know there's not going to be that many. And but I think it is important that you think about your manner. But I think it's important that men do that as well. But since we're talking to the women, I think I do think that has it is important because people will judge us more harshly. That's just the way it is. Other, yes, okay. Yeah, let's. No.
Last year I attended an independent Pentecostal camp meeting in Virginia. And it was mm-hmm. a small fellowship of churches, but they were a denomination. And they asked all the ministers to stand. And I think there were about three of us ladies across. I didn't even know the other ones. And then when we sat down, and when the evangelist got up to preach, they asked all the male ministers to come on the platform and sit.
Specifically said male.
All male ministers, please come to the platform and sit.
Ann Jimenez said that she and John were pastoring Rock Church in Virginia Beach. They were invited over to this church in Norfolk for this some big meeting. And so they were gathered back with all the ministers that were going to be on the platform and, you know, to pray or whatever. And then when they walked out on the platform, she said it occurred to her as she's walking across, they don't have a chair for me. And she said, I felt like a fool. I had to go walk across and then go down and go sit on the front row, you know. And she was the pastor of the church and had been invited, but they didn't want her sitting on that. And those, you know, it's just, there are ways to just model, you know, egalitarianism by who you have on the platform and what you're allowing them to do. The language that you use is just really, really important. Second question I have is, we sort of said some of this, how the perspectives connect with your own experience. Let's move to the next one, the last one. What will it take to make this story different in the future, for you, for your children, your daughters? What will it take?
We need to be teaching our children, the next generation.
Yeah.
I can say, my son.
Yeah, tell that. You told me that story last night about your son, didn't you? That's really good.
Well, I was thinking today, there's a story about both of my sons. I was telling her last night that my oldest son, I guess about a year ago, he and his wife decided they might change churches because where they were going, there wasn't a lot offered for the children their age. And so they started looking for another church, and they found one they liked, and they liked the program, and they liked the ministry from the pulpit. And they'd been going about 3 months, I think. And one Sunday morning, now this was an independent church.
Maybe, can you turn around so they can all hear you? Because there's a lot of noise around here.
So they had started going to a church that was a non-denominational church. And it's in the Raleigh area, a very large church. And they enjoyed the ministry there. And so after about 3 months, the pastor one morning, and I don't know how it came in, he in his message said, now we do not allow women to do this and this and this because of what Paul says. And yes, and those people would say, well, it's not for us, but he said, that's what he said, and that's what we believe. And my son said, we won't be back. Now, my son's not a minister. He's very involved in his church. But he said we will be back. He's married to a very strong woman. But she didn't feel as strongly about it as he did. She said, well, no, that is not right, and we will be back. And they never went back. Now, the interesting thing, my other son was in a supervisory position in the corporate world, and he was hiring engineers, and he calls me one day at work, and he says, Mom, you're not going to believe what happened. He said, I've interviewed this woman for an engineer position in the company, and he said, one of my coworkers came in today, and he said, I know you've interviewed this lady, this woman, whatever you call her, for a position, but if you hire her, I can't work with her. He said, I can't work with a woman. My wife would not approve of me working with a woman, and I cannot work with her. And I almost said to him, and it's people like you who kept my mother from getting an accounting job, only offered a secretarial job years ago. He said, I just wanted to go off on him. So it really starts in the home.
Yeah.
Just training our children.
That's really a good point. I'll tell you this, that I heard Tammy Donahue say in the Four Square Church that they have started from the ground, first ministerial training that's done for all ministers is they start by sharing that men and women are called and just dismantling all of that stuff. And she said it had made a huge difference. And they've had a huge number of women, an uptick in the number of women applying for credentials and all of that, because they know it's an affirming place for them. They're going to be welcomed and they're going to be accepted. I know women, two African American women scholars who grew up in the Church of God in Christ tradition, but they have daughters and they've left their, even though, you know, it's what formed them, they love it, but because they have daughters who could never, if they're called to ministry, be a minister, they left that denomination, you know, even though it's the church of their roots, their heritage, you know. So it does. It's really important that we think about the implications of what we say and what we do for our daughters in the faith, our sons in the faith also, our children. I'm just telling you, I've heard some men argue, again, I pointed that out, so emotionally against women in ministry that as soon as, while I was listening to them, the harshness and hatefulness with which they spoke, my immediate thought was concern about their wives. Because it came across so hateful and angry. And let me say this one other thing, and then I'm going to let Karen, you know, take this how she wants to go. But I probably should have said this earlier, but in my old age, it's probably been 10, 15 years, I've come to think that one of the biggest problems that we have with seeing this fulfilled is that we think the women's issue is a back burner issue. That, okay, well, we've got all this other stuff right, and we'll get there one day, and it's not as important. And it's kind of like that whole thing of, like I said, that they, when it came to Jim Crow laws, they finally said, well, it'd be better for us to just not break the law and not cause problems or whatever for the sake of the gospel. But I'm telling you, the world is watching the church right now. They are watching us. Our young women are watching us. And this is a holiness issue. As I showed you, this comes out of our holiness roots. It's a Pentecostal issue. And I made this statement a couple weeks ago to somebody. They didn't like it, but oh well. You know, I said, I think we could argue that you cease to be a Pentecostal church when you limit certain groups and certain people from ministry. As long as they are Christian, and as long as they are, you know, sanctified, baptized in the Holy Spirit, you know, one of the early hallmark of Pentecostalism was this, as much as it was speaking in tongues. I've come to believe that what we see at Azusa Street, that egalitarianism between races and genders, was as much a sign of the baptism of the Holy Spirit as speaking in tongues was. And that's not to downplay speaking in tongues, because I am a tongue speaker from way back, you know. And I believe I can, you know, I can argue initial evidence. I'm not even a person that really quibbles about that like some people do anymore. But I believe that wasn't the only sign being manifested there. It was the whole thing. The whole thing. And, you know, William Seymour saw what was happening, saw the division, and he started saying, he wasn't denying that tongues was the first physical evidence, but he did say love is the real evidence. Yes. And when we don't love anymore, and, you know, putting another person down, limiting them, denigrating them, and the call of God on their life is putting them down, you know, and it's not loving. It's not loving them. So, anyway, okay, one more, and then, okay.
I'm, of course, not a minister. Okay? I'm a good, tithe-paying layperson. What will it take to make the story different in the future? Right now, in the Pentecostal Holiness Church, we've got to start with the ministers. We already have the majority of the ministers of men.
Mm-hmm.
How many men are here today that are pastors?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's my point. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Strickland, and you others.
Yes.
All right. But they've got to recognize that women can lead the litany, that women can speak other than on the WMJ in March. And they can serve communion, and they've got to utilize their congregation.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to put them in place. Now, we as mothers, we've been telling our girls, I don't have girls, I have granddaughters, but I'm telling them they're as good and they are equal in the sight of God of any man.
Yeah.
Okay. And we're telling them that. But if our leaders that we have been taught to respect and to honor, if they do not take the mantle up and say we're going to put what we believe into practice, we might have more of our women not staying with us, but going someplace where they will be recognized and used.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think it's a good way to end it, you know, because the whole thing is, you've got it right on paper, but there's something else going on in the churches and you're right. I mean, I think this is a great group, and it's a huge group. It's great, but it's not just the women who need to hear this, you know. And so so it needs to be more widely heard. And it needs to be a larger conversation. So I want you to know that I appreciate very much what the Pentecostal Holiness Church has done. You've been leaders in repenting about what has happened in the past with women. That statement in, was it 98 or 96? Was groundbreaking, and I actually, in the book What Women Want, one of the things we did was call for that kind of repentance to be done across all the churches. It needs to happen for repentance for ways women have been treated. You know, Lee Grady represents you well in all of the things. He's constantly on this, and I'm very grateful for that. So you're really leaders. So I would charge you to take up that mantle. You're a leader in this, and you need to be leading other churches as well as your own. So thank you. Oh, okay, Phil?
One question. I know you're trying to wrap up. Just Tracy and I kind of talking here from our context. And again, I again, not a BH church, but a BFWB church, sister denomination, currently as a pastor, I'm not aware of any women who are aspiring or feel a call to pastoral ministry, preaching ministry context. As I shared with you in our conversations, I've been striving at least to get women on the deacon board, which I've not been successful yet, but hopefully at some point. But what would be suggestions to a pastor to try to create a mind shift in the church, a culture that would be more accepting? Right now there's no one striving for that. However, the culture's there when that does happen.
That's a good...
They would be accepting.
Yeah, in the little book, this little book, which is no longer in print, but I guess I'm going to have to try to get it back in print too. Hollis Gauls and I wrote this together, and Hollis died a couple years ago. But there's a story in here somewhere, I'll just share it, a congregation and how they transitioned. This is a Church of God congregation to having women elders. And this was before the Church of God was having elders. So what this pastor did, instead of going with the Church and Pastors Council, which was the way the Church of God had it at that time, and it could only be men, now it can be women on that council, but he was going to have elders. And so what he did was, in the local church, he did a study with the congregation, kind of covertly, he did this with them, of New Testament leadership and the requirements for leadership. And they just went through all of that and then eventually had the conversation about now who in our congregation. And what emerged out of that was there were two or three women who were elected. They saw themselves that, okay, these women, these people meet, because they were like business women and, you know, that were members of the congregation. So one of the ways that you can do it is just look at the text together, study the text together, kind of in a Bible study kind of way. You're having me preach tomorrow, so that's, you know, having women up front, you recognizing, and I know you do this, but, you know, when you see a woman, sometimes women, because they haven't been enculturated to do it, they don't know that that's a calling, you know, and young people often don't. But if you start seeing that, just, you know, start blessing that, start finding ways, you know, I think you'd be good for this, and have you considered, because I think a lot of times young people going into ministry, but especially women, because they don't know they can, they need somebody to kind of tug them along. But I think, I think you can do things like in sermons, build in these stories of some of these women. You know, we all tell stories in our sermons, but use stories of some of these, you know, these women. And you don't have to be saying, doesn't have to be a sermon about women in ministry, just use the woman as the story. You know, the women in the Bible, preach on these women in the Bible. Modeling, I think modeling it is really important. And it can happen, but it does happen a lot of times. Changing a congregation is a slower thing. And you have a different polity as well, so that makes it... it all has to do... what your polity is really matters, because, what your authority is and those kinds of things. But what you can do, like if you've been given the authority to preach, or you've been given the authority to teach, or you've been, you know, whatever your job is, then find ways to make that happen. And it can change. I've seen it. I've seen some things change in some churches that I never would have dreamed that could happen. And so that's, you know, those are some simple ideas, but somebody else may have others of how they've transitioned. But I do know that one congregation, that's what they did. They just studied the New Testament leadership models, and then finally it was like, oh, okay, well.
The light
came on. Huh? The light came on, yeah, yeah.
Which came back to training.
Mm-hmm.
I keep thinking on that third quote, if you dig all the way through what is the root cause of this, training has a lot to do with
yeah,
that.
Yeah. On the local level. What are they reading? What are they? Yeah, yeah. And, you know, just like in any pastoral thing, remember that a lot of these, you know, the men in the church who are so worked up against it, there's a culture, they're buying into a fear thing. I always think about the first couple of chapters of Exodus, where, you know, the Pharaoh says, if we don't stop this, they're going to take over and they'll kill us all, you know. Well, that's always the root of prejudices. It's fear of losing position, losing power, and those kind of things. And so a lot of these people are seeing so many changes, and they're very afraid. And so they lash out, and they get harsh, and they want to maintain their control where they have it. And so, you know, it's like that old thing in the South where, you know, a lot people in the, say, the Ku Klux Klan, they might have been just, you know, excuse the phrase, but just like poor white trash people, right? They had nothing. What my mother would say was they didn't have a pot to pee in, you know. Now that's on the podcast, isn't it? Well, anyway, I just dawned on me. But anyway, they had nothing. But one of the things that caused them to be so hostile to African Americans and the other groups that they were is you got to be better than somebody. So it's about power. You know, I've already got nothing. They've taken everything from me, so I can beat up on that person down below. And so that kind of fear of losing place is what causes a lot of this pushback that we get. So, okay.
Thank you so much.